Not?
Did too. We just met for the very first time, and as soon as you laid eyes on me, you said, "That's the man I'm going to marry," and you pasted me one. I always said you were an excellent judge of character.
Thursday, September 29th, 1977. Claire is 6. Henry is 35. The calendar on Daddy's desk this morning said the same as the paper the man wrote. Nell was making a soft egg for Alicia, and Etta was yelling at Mark because he didn't do his homework and played frisbee with Steve. I said, "Etta, can I have some clothes from the trunks?" Meaning the trunks in the attic where we play dress-up, and Etta said, "What for?" And I said, "I want to play dress-up with Megan," and Etta got mad and said it was time to go to school and I could worry about playing when I got home. So I went to school, and we did adding, and mealworms, and language arts, and after lunch, French, and music, and religion. I worried all day about pants for the man, because he seemed like he really wanted pants. So when I got home, I went to ask Etta again, but she was in town. But Nell let me lick both the beaters of cake batter, which Etta won't let us because you get salmon. And Mama was writing, and I was going to go away without asking, but she said, "What is it, baby?" So I asked, and she said I could go look in the Goodwill bags and have anything I wanted. So I went to the laundry room and looked in the Goodwill bags and found 3 pairs of Daddy's pants, but one had a big cigarette hole. So I took 2, and I found a white shirt like Daddy wears to work and a tie with fishes on it and a red sweater and the yellow bathrobe that Daddy had when I was little, and it smelled like Daddy. I put the clothes in a bag and put the bag in the mudroom closet. When I was coming out of the mudroom, Mark saw me, and he said, "What are you doing, asshole?" And I said, "Nothing, asshole." And he pulled my hair, and I stepped on his foot really hard, and then he started to cry and went to tell. So I went up to my room and played television with Mr. Bear and Jane, where Jane is the movie star, and Mr. Bear asks her about how it is being a movie star, and she says she really wants to be a veterinarian, but she is so incredibly pretty she has to be a movie star. And Mr. Bear says maybe she could be a veterinarian when she's old. And Etta knocked and said, "Why are you stepping on Mark?" And I said, "Because Mark pulled my hair for no reason." And Etta said, "You two are getting on my nerves," and went away. So that was okay. We ate dinner with just Etta, because Daddy and Mama went to a party. It was fried chicken, with little peas, and chocolate cake. And Mark got the biggest piece, but I didn't say anything, because I licked the beaters. So after dinner, I asked Etta if I could go outside. And she said, "Did I have homework?" And I said, "Spelling and bring leaves for art class." And she said, "Okay, as long as you come in by dark." So I went and got my blue sweater with the zebras, and I got the bag, and I went out and went to the clearing. But the man wasn't there, and I sat on the rock for a while, and then I thought I'd better get some leaves. So I went back to the garden and found some leaves from Mama's little tree that she told me later was ginkgo, and some leaves from the maple and the oak. So then I went back to the clearing. He still wasn't there, and I thought, well, I guess he just made up that he was coming, and he didn't want pants so bad after all. And I thought maybe Ruth was right, because I told her about the man, and she said I was making it up because people don't disappear in real life, only on TV. Or maybe it was a dream, like when Buster died and I dreamed he was okay and he was in his cage, but I woke up and no Buster. And Mama said, "Dreams are different than real life, but important too." And it was getting cold, and I thought, maybe I should just leave the bag, and if the man came, he could have his pants. So I was walking back up the path, and there was this noise, and somebody said, "Ouch! Dang, that hurt." And then I was scared.
I kind of slam into the rock when I appear and scrape my knees. I'm in the clearing, and the sun is setting beautifully in a spectacular J.M.W. Turner blowout orange and red over the trees. The clearing is empty except for a shopping bag full of clothes, and I rapidly deduce that Claire has left these, and this is probably a day shortly after our first meeting. Claire is nowhere in sight, and I call her name softly. No response. I dig through the bag of clothes. There's a pair of chinos and the beautiful pair of brown wool trousers, a hideous tie with trout all over it, the Harvard sweater, the Oxford cloth white shirt with ring around the collar and sweat stains under the arms, and the exquisite silk bathrobe with Phillips monogram and a big tear over the pocket. All these clothes are old friends, except for the tie, and I'm happy to see them. I don the chinos and the sweater and bless Claire's apparently hereditary good taste and sense. I feel great, Except for the lack of shoes, I'm well equipped for my current location in space-time.
Thanks, Claire. You did a great job,
I call softly. I'm surprised when she appears at the entrance to the clearing. It's getting dark quickly, and Claire looks tiny and scared in the half-light.
Hi.
Hi, Claire. Thanks for the clothes. They're perfect, and they'll keep me nice and warm tonight.
I have to go in soon.
That's okay. It's almost dark. Is it a school night?
Uh-huh.
What's the date?
Thursday, September 29th, 1977.
That's very helpful, thanks.
How come you don't know that?
Well, I just got here. A few minutes ago, it was Monday, March 27th, 2000. It was a rainy morning, and I was making toast.
But you wrote it down for me.
She takes out a piece of Phillips' law office letterhead and holds it out for me. I walk to her and take it, and am interested to see the date written on it in my careful block lettering. I pause and grope for the best way to explain the vagaries of time travel to the small child who is Claire at the moment. It's like this. You know how to use a tape recorder?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you put in a tape and you play it from the beginning to the end, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's how your life is. You get up in the morning and you eat breakfast and you brush your teeth and you go to school, right? You don't get up and suddenly find yourself at school eating lunch with Helen and Ruth, and then all of a sudden you're at home getting dressed, right? Claire giggles.
Right.
Now, for me, it's different. Because I'm a time traveler, I jump around a lot from one time to another. So it's like if you started the tape and played it for a while, but then you said, oh, I want to hear that song again. So you played that song, and then you went back to where you left off, but you wound the tape too far ahead. So you rewound it again, but you still got it too far ahead. You see?
Sort of.
Well, it's not the greatest analogy in the world. Basically, sometimes I get lost in time, and I don't know when I am.
What's analogy?
It's when you try to explain something by saying it's like another thing. For example, at the moment I am snug as a bug in a rug in this nice sweater, and you are as pretty as a picture. And Etta is going to be as mad as a hatter if you don't go in pretty soon.
Are you going to sleep here? You could come to our house. We have a guest room.
Gosh, that's very nice of you. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to meet your family until 1991. Claire is utterly perplexed. I think part of the problem is that she can't imagine dates beyond the 70s. I remember having the same problem with the 60s when I was her age.
Why not?
It's part of the rules. People who time travel aren't supposed to go around talking to regular people while they visit their times, because we might mess things up. Actually, I don't believe this. Things happen the way they happened once and only once. I'm not a proponent of splitting universes.
But you talk to me.
You're special. You're brave and smart and good at keeping secrets. Claire is embarrassed.
I told Ruth, but she didn't believe me.
Oh, well, don't worry about it. Very few people ever believe me either, especially doctors. Doctors don't believe anything unless you can prove it to them.
I believe you.
Claire is standing about 5 feet away from me. Her small, pale face catches the last orange light from the west. Her hair is pulled back tightly into a ponytail, and she is wearing blue jeans and a dark sweater with zebras running across the chest. Her hands are clenched, and she looks fierce and determined. Our daughter, I think, sadly, would have looked like this. Thank you, Claire.
I have to go in now.
Good idea.
Are you coming back?
I consult the list from memory. I'll be back October 16th. It's a Friday. Come here right after school. Bring that little blue diary Megan gave you for your birthday and a blue ballpoint pen. I repeat the date, looking at Claire to make sure she is remembering. Au revoir, Claire.
Au revoir,
Henry.
Au revoir, Henri.
Already, her accent is better than mine. Claire turns and runs up the path into the arms of her lighted and welcoming house, and I turn to the dark and begin to walk across the meadow. Later in the evening, I chuck the tie in the dumpster behind Dina's Fish and Fry. Lessons in Survival. Thursday, June 7th, 1973. Henry is 27 and 9. I am standing across the street from the Art Institute of Chicago on a sunny June day in 1973 in the company of my 9-year-old self. He is traveling from next Wednesday. I have come from 1990. We have a long afternoon and evening to frivol as we will, and so we have come to one of the great art museums of the world for a little lesson in pickpocketing.
"Can't we just look at the art?" pleads Henry. He's nervous. He's never done this before.
"Nope. You need to know this. How are you going to survive if you can't steal anything?"
"Begging?"
"Begging is a drag, and you keep getting carted off by the police. Now listen, when we get in there, I want you to stay away from me and pretend we don't know each other. But be close enough to watch what I'm doing. If I hand you anything, don't drop it, and put it in your pocket as fast as you can, okay?"
"I guess." "Can we go see St. George?"
"Sure." We cross Michigan Avenue and walk between students and housewives sunning themselves on the museum steps. Henry pats one of the bronze lions as we go by. I feel moderately bad about this whole thing. On the one hand, I am providing myself with urgently required survival skills. Other lessons in this series include shoplifting, beating people up, picking locks, climbing trees, driving, housebreaking, dumpster diving, and how to use oddball things like Venetian blinds and garbage can lids as weapons. On the other hand, I'm corrupting my poor innocent little self. I sigh. Somebody's got to do it. It's free day, so the place is swarming with people. We stand in line, move through the entry, and slowly climb the grandiose central staircase. We enter the European galleries and make our way backward from the 17th century Netherlands to 15th century Spain. St. George stands poised, as always, ready to transfix his dragon with his delicate spear, while the pink and green princess waits demurely in the middle ground. Myself and I love the yellow-bellied dragon wholeheartedly, and we are always relieved to find that his moment of doom has still not arrived. Henry and I stand before Bernardo Martorell's painting for 5 minutes, and then he turns to me. We have the gallery to ourselves at the moment.
"It's not so hard," I say. "Pay attention. Look for someone who's distracted. Figure out where the wallet is. Most men use either their back pocket or the inside pocket of their suit jacket. With women, you want the purse behind their back. If you're on the street, you can just grab the whole purse, but then you have to be sure you can outrun anybody who might decide to chase you. It's much quieter if you can take it without them noticing." "I saw a movie where they practiced with a suit of clothes with little bells, and if the guy moved the suit while he took the wallet, the bells rang."
"Yeah, I remember that movie. You can try that at home. Now, follow me." I lead Henry from the 15th century to the 19th. We arrive suddenly in the midst of French Impressionism. The Art Institute is famous for its Impressionist collection. I can take it or leave it, but as usual, these rooms are jam-packed with people craning for a glimpse of La Grande Jatte or a Monet haystack. Henry can't see over the heads of the adults, so the paintings are lost on him, but he's too nervous to look at them anyway. I scan the room. A woman is bending over her toddler as it twists and screams. Must be nap time. I nod at Henry and move toward her. Her purse has a simple clasp and is slung over her shoulder across her back. She's totally focused on getting her child to stop screeching. She's in front of Toulouse-Lautrec's At the Moulin Rouge. I pretend to be looking at it as I walk, bump into her, sending her pitching forward. I catch her arm. I'm so sorry, forgive me, I wasn't looking. Are you all right? It's so crowded in here. My hand is in her purse. She's flustered. She has dark eyes and long hair, large breasts. She's still trying to lose the weight she gained having the kid. I catch her eye as I find her wallet, still apologizing. The wallet goes up my jacket sleeve. I look her up and down and smile, back away, turn, walk, look over my shoulder. She has picked up her boy and is staring back at me, slightly forlorn. I smile and walk. Walk. Henry is following me as I take the stairs down to the Junior Museum. We rendezvous by the men's toilets.
That was weird, says Henry. Why does she look at you like that?
She's lonely, I euphemize. Maybe her husband isn't around very much. We cram ourselves into a stall and I open her wallet. Her name is Denise Radke. She lives in Villa Park, Illinois. She is a member of the museum and an alumna of Roosevelt University. She is carrying $22 in cash plus change. I show all this to Henry, silently, put the wallet back as it was, and hand it to him. We walk out of the stall, out of the men's room, back toward the entrance to the museum. Give this to the guard. Say you found it on the floor.
Why?
We don't need it. I was just demonstrating. Henry runs to the guard, an elderly black woman who smiles and gives Henry a sort of half-hug. He comes back slowly, and we walk 10 feet apart, with me leading down the long, dark corridor which will someday house decorative arts and lead to the as-yet-unthought-of rice wing, but which at the moment is full of posters. I'm looking for easy marks, and just ahead of me is a perfect illustration of the pickpocket's dream. Short, portly, sunburnt. He looks as though he's made a wrong turn from Wrigley Field in his baseball cap and polyester trousers with light blue short-sleeve button-down shirt. He's lecturing his mousy girlfriend on Vincent van Gogh.
So, he cuts his ear off and gives it to his girl. Hey, how do you like that for a present, huh? An ear! Huh. So, they put him in the loony bin.
I have no qualms about this one. He strolls on, braying, blissfully unaware, with his wallet in his left back pocket. He has a large gut, but almost no backside, and his wallet is pretty much aching for me to take it. I amble along behind him. Henry has a clear view as I deftly insert my thumb and forefinger into the mark's pocket and liberate the wallet. I drop back, they walk on. I pass the wallet to Henry, and he shoves it into his pants as I walk ahead. I show Henry some other techniques. How to take a wallet from the inside breast pocket of a suit, how to shield your hand from view while it's inside a woman's purse, 6 different ways to distract someone while you take their wallet, how to take a wallet out of a backpack, and how to get someone to inadvertently show you where their money is. He's more relaxed now. He's even starting to enjoy this. Finally, I say, okay, now you try. He's instantly petrified.
I can't.
Sure you can. Look around. Find someone. We are standing in the Japanese print room. It's full of old ladies.
Not here.
Okay, where? He thinks for a minute.
The restaurant?
We walk quietly to the restaurant. I remember this all vividly. I was totally terrified. I look over at myself, and sure enough, his face is white with fear. I'm smiling because I know what comes next. We stand at the end of the line for the garden restaurant. Henry looks around, thinking. In front of us in line is a very tall, middle-aged man wearing a beautifully cut brown lightweight suit. It's impossible to see where the wallet is. Henry approaches him with one of the wallets I've lifted earlier, proffered on his outstretched hand.
"Sir, is this yours?"
says Henry softly.
"It was on the floor."
"Huh? No." The man checks his right back pants pocket, finds his wallet safe, leans over Henry to hear him better, takes the wallet from Henry and opens it.
My, you should take this to the security guards. There's quite a bit of cash in here, yes.
The man wears thick glasses and peers at Henry through them as he speaks, and Henry reaches around under the man's jacket and steals his wallet. Since Henry's wearing a short-sleeved T-shirt, I walk behind him and he passes the wallet to me. The tall, thin, brown-suited man points at the stairs, explaining to Henry how to turn in the wallet. Henry toddles off in the direction the man has indicated, and I follow, overtake Henry, and lead him right through the museum to the entrance and out, past the guards, onto Michigan Avenue and south, until we end up grinning like fiends at the Artist Cafe, where we treat ourselves to milkshakes and French fries with some of our ill-gotten gains. Afterwards, we throw all the wallets in a mailbox, sans cash, and I get us a room at the Palmer House. So? I ask, sitting on the side of the bathtub, watching Henry brush his teeth.
What?
Returns Henry with a mouthful of toothpaste. What do you think? He spits.
About what?
Pickpocketing. He looks at me in the mirror.
It's okay.
He turns and looks directly at me.
I did it.
He grins largely.
You were brilliant.
Yeah.
The grin fades.
Henry, I don't like to time travel by myself. It's better with you. Can't you always come with me?
He is standing with his back to me, and we look at each other in the mirror. Poor, small self. At this age, my back is thin and my shoulder blades stick out like incipient wings. He turns, waiting for an answer, and I know what I have to tell him. Me. I reach out and gently turn him and bring him to stand by me, so we are side by side, heads level, facing the mirror. Look. We study our reflections, twinned in the ornate gilt Palmer House bathroom splendor. Our hair is the same brown-black, our eyes slant, dark, and fatigue-ringed identically. We sport exact replicas of each other's ears. I'm taller and more muscular in shave. He's slender and ungainly and is all knees and elbows. I reach up and pull my hair back from my face, show him the scar from the accident. Unconsciously, he mimics my gesture, touches the same scar on his own forehead.
It's just like mine,
says myself, amazed.
How did you get it?
The same as you. It is the same. We are the same. A translucent moment. I didn't understand, and then I did, just like that. I watch it happen.
I want to be both of us at once. Feel again the feeling of losing the edges of myself, of seeing the admixture of future and present for the first time.
But I'm too accustomed, too comfortable with it. And so I'm left on the outside, remembering the wonder of being 9 and suddenly seeing, knowing that my friend, guide, brother was me.
Me. Only me.
The loneliness of it.
You're me.
When you were older.
But what about the others?
Other time travelers? He nods. I don't think there are any. I mean, I've never met any others. A tear gathers at the edge of his left eye. When I was little, I imagined a whole society of time travelers, of which Henry, my teacher, was an emissary, sent to train me for eventual inclusion in this vast camaraderie. I still feel like a castaway, the last member of a once numerous species. It was as though Robinson Crusoe discovered the telltale footprint on the beach and then realized that it was his own. Myself, small as a leaf, thin as water, begins to cry. I hold him. Hold me for a long time. Later, we order hot chocolate from room service and watch Johnny Carson. Henry falls asleep with the light on. As the show ends, I look over at him, and he's gone. Vanished back to my old room in my dad's apartment, standing sleep-addled beside my old bed, falling into it gratefully. I turn off the TV and the bedside lamp. 1973 street noises drift in the open window. I want to go home. I lie on the hard hotel bed, desolate, alone. I still don't understand. Sunday, December 10th, 1978. Henry is 15 and 15. I'm in my bedroom with myself. He's here from next March. We're doing what we often do when we have a little privacy, when it's cold out, when both of us are past puberty and haven't quite gotten around to actual girls yet. I think most people would do this if they had the sort of opportunities I have. I mean, I'm not gay or anything. It's late Sunday morning. I can hear the bells ringing at St. Joe's. Dad came home late last night. I think he must have stopped at the Exchequer after the concert. He was so drunk he fell down on the stairs, and I had to haul him into the apartment and put him to bed. He coughs, and I hear him messing around in the kitchen. My other self seems distracted. He keeps looking at the door. "What?" I ask him. "Nothing," he says. I get up and check the lock. "No," he says. He seems to be making a huge effort to speak. "Come on," I say. I hear Dad's heavy step right outside my door. "Henry?" he says, and the knob of the door slowly turns, and I abruptly realize that I have inadvertently unlocked the door, and Henry leaps for it, but it's too late. Dad sticks his head in, and there we are, in flagrante delicto. "Oh," he says. His eyes are wide, and he looks completely disgusted.
"Jesus, Henry."
He shuts the door, and I hear him walking back to his room. I throw myself a reproachful glare as I pull on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. I walk down the hall to Dad's bedroom. His door is shut. I knock. No answer. I wait. "Dad?" Silence. I open the door, stand in the doorway. "Dad?" He's sitting with his back to me on his bed. He continues to sit, and I stand there for a while, but I can't bring myself to walk into the room. Finally, I shut the door, walk back to my own room.
"That was completely and totally your fault," I tell myself severely.
He is wearing jeans, sitting on the chair with his head in his hands.
You knew that was going to happen, and you didn't say a word. Where is your sense of self-preservation? What the hell is wrong with you? What use is it knowing the future if you can't at least protect us from humiliating little scenes?
"Shut up," Henry croaks. "Just shut up."
"I will not shut up," I say, my voice rising. "I mean, all you had to do was say,
'Listen.'"
He looks up at me with resignation. It was like that day at the ice skating rink. Oh, shit. A couple of years ago, I saw a little girl get hit in the head with a hockey puck at Indian Head Park. It was horrible. I found out later that she died in the hospital. And then I started to time travel back to that day over and over, and I wanted to warn her mother, and I couldn't. It was like being in the audience at a movie. It was like being a ghost. I would scream, "No, take her home. Don't let her near the ice. Take her away. She's going to get hurt. She's going to die." And I would realize that the words were only in my head, and everything would go on as before. Henry says,
You talk about changing the future, but for me this is the past, and as far as I can tell, there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, I tried, and it was the trying that made it happen. If I hadn't said something, you wouldn't have gotten up.
Then why did you say anything?
Because I did. You will. Just wait. He shrugs. It's like with Mom. The accident. Immer wieder. Always again. Always the same.
Free will?
He gets up, walks to the window, stands looking out over the Tattinger's backyard. I was just talking about that with a self from 1992. He said something interesting. He said that he thinks there is only free will when you're in time, in the present. He says in the past we can only do what we did, and we can only be there if we were there. But whenever I am, that's my present. Shouldn't I be able to decide?
No,
apparently not.
What did he say about the future?
Well, think. You go to the future, you do something, you come back to the present. Then the thing that you did is part of your past. So that's probably inevitable, too. I feel a weird combination of freedom and despair. I'm sweating. He opens the window and cold air floods into the room.
But then, I'm not responsible for anything I do while I'm not in the present.
He smiles. Thank God.
And everything has already happened.
Sure looks that way. He runs his hand over his face, and I see that he could use a shave.
But he said that you have to behave as though you have free will, as though you are responsible for what you do.
Why? What does it matter?
Apparently, if you don't, things are bad. Depressing.
Did he know that personally?
Yes.
So what happens next?
Dad ignores you for 3 weeks, and this, he waves his hand at the bed, we've got to stop meeting like this.
I sigh.
Right, no problem.
Anything else?
Vivian Teska.
Vivian is this girl in geometry whom I lust after. I've never said a word to her. After class tomorrow, go up to her and ask her out.
I don't even know her.
Trust me. He's smirking at me in a way that makes me wonder why on earth I would ever trust him, but I want to believe.
Okay.
I should get going. Money, please. I dole out $20.
More.
I hand him another 20.
That's all I've got.
Okay. He's dressing, pulling clothes from the stash of things I don't mind never seeing again.
How about a coat?
I hand him a Peruvian skiing sweater that I've always hated. He makes a face and puts it on. We walk to the back door of the apartment. The church bells are tolling noon.
Bye,
says myself. Good luck, I say, oddly moved by the sight of me embarking into the unknown, into a cold Chicago Sunday morning he doesn't belong in. He thumps down the wooden stairs, and I turn to the silent apartment.
Wednesday, November 17th, and Tuesday, September 28th, 1982. Henry is 19. I'm in the back of a police car in Zion, Illinois. I'm wearing handcuffs and not much else. The interior of this particular police car smells like cigarettes, leather, sweat, and another odor I can't identify that seems endemic to police cars. The odor of freak-outedness, perhaps. My left eye is swelling shut, and the front of my body is covered with bruises and cuts and dirt from being tackled by the larger of the two policemen in an empty lot full of broken glass. The policemen are standing outside the car talking to the neighbors, at least one of whom evidently saw me trying to break into the yellow and white Victorian house we are parked in front of. I don't know where I am in time. I've been here for about an hour, and I have fucked up completely. I'm very hungry. I'm very tired. I'm supposed to be in Dr. Quarry's Shakespeare seminar, but I'm sure I've managed to miss it. Too bad we're doing Midsummer Night's Dream. The upside of this police car is it's warm and I'm not in Chicago. Chicago's finest hate me because I keep disappearing while I'm in custody and they can't figure it out. Also, I refuse to talk to them, so they still don't know who I am or where I live. The day they find out, I'm toast, because there are several outstanding warrants for my arrest. Breaking and entering, shoplifting, resisting arrest, breaking arrest, trespassing, indecent exposure, robbery, und so weiter. From this, one might deduce that I'm a very inept criminal, but really the main problem is that it's so hard to be inconspicuous when you're naked. Stealth and speed are my main assets, and so when I try to burgle houses in broad daylight stark naked, sometimes it doesn't work out. I've been arrested 7 times, and so far I've always vanished before they can fingerprint me or take a photo. The neighbors keep peering in the windows of the police car at me. I don't care. I don't care. This is taking a long time. Fuck, I hate this. I lean back and close my eyes. A car door opens. Cold air. My eyes fly open. For an instant, I see the metal grid that separates the front of the car from the back. The cracked vinyl seats, my hands in the cuffs, my goose-flesh legs, the flat sky through the windshield, the black visored hat on the dashboard, the clipboard in the officer's hand, his red face, tufted graying eyebrows and jowls like drapes. Everything shimmers, iridescent, butterfly wing colors, and the policeman says, "Hey! He's having some kind of fit!" And my teeth are chattering hard, and before my eyes the police car vanishes, and I am lying on my back in my own backyard. Yes. Yes! I fill my lungs with the sweet September night air. I sit up and rub my wrists, still marked where the handcuffs were. I laugh and laugh. I have escaped again. Houdini, Prospero, behold me, for I am a magician too. Nausea overcomes me, and I heave bile onto Kimmy's mums.
Saturday, May 14th, 1983. Claire is 11, almost 12. It's Mary Christina Hepworth's birthday, and all the fifth-grade girls from St. Basil's are sleeping over at her house. We have pizza and Cokes and fruit salad for dinner, and Mrs. Hepworth made a big cake shaped like a unicorn's head with "Happy Birthday, Mary Christina" in red icing. And we sing, and Mary Christina blows out all 12 candles in one blow. I think I know what she wished for. I think she wished not to get any taller. That's what I would wish if I were her, anyway. Mary Christina is the tallest person in our class. She's 5'9". Her mom is a little shorter than her, but her dad is really, really tall. Helen asked Mary Christina once, and she said he's 6'7". She's the only girl in her family, and her brothers are all older and shave, and they're really tall, too. They make a point of ignoring us and eating a lot of cake, and Patty and Ruth especially giggle a lot whenever they come where we are. It's so embarrassing. Mary Christina opens her presents. I got her a green sweater just like my blue one that she liked, with the crocheted collar, from Laura Ashley. After dinner, we watch The Parent Trap on video, and the Hepworth family kind of hangs around watching us until we all take turns putting on our pajamas in the second-floor bathroom, and we crowd into Mary Christina's room that is decorated totally in pink, even the wall-to-wall carpet. You get the feeling Mary Christina's parents were really glad to finally have a girl after all those brothers. We have all brought our sleeping bags, but we pile them against one wall and sit on Mary Christina's bed and on the floor. Nancy has a bottle of peppermint schnapps and we all drink some. It tastes awful, and it feels like Vicks VapoRub in my chest. We play Truth or Dare. Ruth dares Wendy to run down the hall without her top on. Wendy asks Francie what size bra Lexi, Francie's 17-year-old sister, wears. Answer, 38D. Francie asks Gail what she was doing with Michael Plattner at the Dairy Queen last Saturday. Answer, eating ice cream. Well, duh. After a while, we all get bored with Truth or Dare, mainly because it's hard to think of good dares that any of us will actually do, and because we all pretty much know whatever there is to know about each other because we've been going to school together since kindergarten. Mary Christina says, "Let's do Ouija board!" And we all agree, because it's her party, and because Ouija board is cool. She gets it out of her closet. The box is all mashed, and the little plastic thing that shows the letters is missing its plastic window. Henry told me once that he went to a séance, and the medium had her appendix burst in the middle of it, and they had to call an ambulance. The board is only really big enough for two people to do it at once, so Mary Christina and Helen go first. The rule is you have to ask what you want to know out loud, or it won't work. They each put their fingers on the plastic thing. Helen looks at Mary Christina, who hesitates, and Nancy says, "Ask about Bobby." So Mary Christina asks, "Does Bobby Duxler like me?" Everybody giggles. The answer is no, but the Ouija says yes, with a little pushing by Helen. Mary Christina smiles so hugely I can see her braces top and bottom. Helen asks if any boys like her. The Ouija circles around for a while and then stops on D-A-V. "David Hanley?" says Patty, and everybody laughs. Dave is the only black kid in our class. He's real shy and small, and he's good at math. "Maybe he'll help you with long division," says Laura, who is also very shy. Helen laughs. She's terrible at math. "Here, Claire, you and Ruth try." We take Helen and Mary Christina's places. Ruth looks at me and I shrug. "I don't know what to ask," I say. Everybody snickers. How many possible questions are there? But there are so many things I want to know. Is Mama going to be okay? Why was Daddy yelling at Etta this morning? Is Henry a real person? Where did Mark hide my French homework? Ruth says, "What boys like Claire?" I give her a mean look, but she just smiles. "Don't you want to know?" "No," I say, but I put my fingers on the white plastic anyway. Ruth puts her fingers on, too, and nothing moves. We are both touching the thing very lightly. We are trying to do it right and not push. Then it starts to move. Slow. It goes in circles and then stops on H. Then it speeds up. E-N-R-Y. "Henry," says Mary Christina. "Who's Henry?" Helen says, "I don't know, but you're blushing, Claire. Who is Henry?" I just shake my head like it's a mystery to me, too. "You ask, Ruth." She asks, big surprise, who likes her. The Ouija spells out R-I-C-K. I can feel her pushing. Rick is Mr. Malone, our science teacher, who has a crush on Miss Engel, the English teacher. Everybody except Patty laughs. Patty has a crush on Mr. Malone, too. Ruth and I get up, and Laura and Nancy sit down. Nancy has her back to me, so I can't see her face when she asks, "Who is Henry?" Everybody looks at me and gets real quiet. I watch the board. Nothing. Just as I'm thinking I'm safe, the plastic thing starts to move. H, it says. I think maybe it will just spell Henry again. After all, Nancy and Laura don't know anything about Henry. I don't even know that much about Henry. Then it goes on. U-S-B-A-N-D. They all look at me. "Well, I'm not married. I'm only 11. "But who's Henry?" wonders Laura. "I don't know. Maybe he's somebody I haven't met yet." She nods. Everyone is weirded out. I'm very weirded out. Husband? Husband?
Thursday, April 12th, 1984. Henry is 36. Claire is 12. Claire and I are playing chess in the fire circle in the woods. It's a beautiful spring day, and the woods are alive with birds courting and birds nesting. We are keeping ourselves out of the way of Claire's family, who are out and about this afternoon. Claire has been stuck in her move for a while. I took her queen 3 moves ago, and now she's doomed but determined to go down fighting. She looks up.
Henry, who's your favorite beetle?
John, of course.
Why of course?
Well, Ringo's okay, but kind of a sad sack, you know? And George is a little too new age for my taste.
What's new age?
Oddball religions. Sappy, boring music, pathetic attempts to convince oneself of the superiority of anything connected with Indians, non-Western medicine.
But you don't like regular medicine.
And that's because doctors are always trying to tell me I'm crazy. If I had a broken arm, I'd be a big fan of Western medicine.
What about Paul?
Paul is for girls. Claire smiles shyly.
I like Paul best.
Well, you're a girl.
Why is Paul for girls?
Tread carefully, I tell myself. Paul is, like, the nice beetle, you know?
Is that bad?
No, not at all. But guys are more interested in being cool, and John is the cool beetle.
Oh, but he's dead.
I laugh. You can still be cool.